Riding a reindeer is like riding a fluffy cloud. We were just up, we just arrived, and there's a custom of offering people like a black tea with milk. It was milking season when we were there. Obviously, milk isn't available all year round because refrigeration is not a thing, right? It's a whole thing, but we were lucky. We got reindeer milk tea. It was delicious. It was a bit of a cultural experience because they were eating marmot, like fire roasted marmot. I tried a piece. It tastes fine. Dust started falling. And suddenly you had a whole herd of yak just wandering into camp. The cows showed up and the sheep and goats showed up and they just stayed there for the night. It's not easy to herd a herd of reindeer with 10 people together, but you can work together, but it was a lot of fun. So you just, oh, that one's going, I'll bring it back. Yeah, it's a good time. Welcome to Happy Trails, the podcast for trail riders. Episode 20, Reindeer Riding in Mongolia. Hi, I'm your host, Jess. I travel around the country full-time with my horses. I'm a modern nomad, and in my travels, I've met a lot of cool people. And I created this podcast as a way to share their stories. My guest today is Verena Sutherland, who recently got back from a two-week trip to Mongolia, where she traveled around not only riding horses, but also reindeer. Her trip was really cool. She had an awesome experience, and I'm so excited to have her here to share it with us today. Just a quick note, this interview was recorded on video, so if you're listening to the audio version, switch over to the Ride Climb YouTube channel so you can see Verena and I talk face-to-face and photos and videos of all the cool places she's been. Also, if you want to support the podcast, I would really appreciate if you bought me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/ride climb. All right. Let's saddle up and get started. Thanks so much for coming on to talk to me today. I am so excited to talk to you about your recent trip to Mongolia. Can you tell me how long you were there, why you went, and some of the things you did, and then we'll dig into the details.
That sounds like a plan. Yeah, so this is again another Facebook connection, just like you and I are connected via Facebook. So a Facebook friend of mine who I'd not met in person, her name is Callie King, put out on Facebook that her partner was unable to join her on a trip to Mongolia and if anybody wanted to take that spot. And since I'm a kind of an adventurous, spontaneous person and I had some savings, I was like, Mongolia, that sounds interesting. Tell me more. And she sent me kind of the trip information and I decided to jump on it. A lot of people tend to prepare those journeys about a year in advance and I had 3 months to get all the funds and get all the stuff together. So I ended up flying out on August 20th. I spent a couple of days in the capital. And then I went to kind of very close to the Russian border to meet the people who herd reindeer out there.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Yeah, it's wild. It's so wild. I mean, it's not like a tourist experience the way, let's say I went to Greece earlier in the year. So this was a very travel heavy year for me. And in Greece, you're like staying in a nice hotel or in an Airbnb and you're like having your cush tourist experience. It was not like that. We were like camping with the herding families and things like that, and kind of living, diving into their lifestyle. So it was a very different kind of experience as a traveler for me.
Tell me what that experience was like. Were you sleeping in tents or were you sleeping in the gurs with the families? And what was it like integrating into their daily life?
Yeah, so I think I have to tell you a little bit more about how the trip was structured, just so you can have kind of an idea of all the stuff we did, because it really depended on who we were spending time with. So from the capital, Ulaanbaatar, we flew out to a place called Moron. It's just a little town, bless their hearts. They had like a vision statement at their airport and their vision was to become a hub for travel. And I'm like, okay, well, that's not going to happen. It's very like little. And then we hopped into cars, like, cars that could take us overland because the first 30 minutes were on paved road and the rest, I think it was about 7 or 8 hours of driving, were on just like across the steppe essentially. And that wasn't paved. Those were like basically roads that had become roads by people driving on them with motorcycles, cars. I mean, this is a nomadic people. And even though they have cars, you know, and use them in this way, not all of them, but a lot of them do, they're still moving around. So, you know, it's you'll see in some of the pictures that I'll share, and you might be able to put that there, but it's just like moving across this land is slow and beautiful and kind of wild. So we camped the first night in tents. It was so bumpy. Oh my goodness. A couple of us got pretty bad motion sickness. If I stayed off my phone and just kind of kept my eyes on the horizon, I was good. But yeah, we had some belly upset happening.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. Then the first night we camped with our drivers. The drivers slept in the cars and we slept in the tents. It was a bit of a cultural experience because they were eating marmot.
Wow.
Like fire roasted marmot. I tried a piece. It tastes fine. It's not offensive. And then the day after that, we arrived at what we called horse camp. So it was pretty adventurous trying to find it because obviously the herders move around. So the people living on the steppe, the nomads, move around about four times per year. And they move with their herd of horses, their herd of cows, their herd of yak, their herd of sheep, whatever they have. Usually it's a combination. So these families had cows, yak, sheep, goats, and of course horses. And we stayed with them in a ger that they had emptied for us. It's like a yurt type thing. It was basically just for us when we weren't sleeping with the family, but it was a family ger. And I believe that the kids had to like pile in with the parents and the grandparents to make some room for us.
How big of a space is a typical ger?
They can be, so they seem to be kind of a little bit of a standard size. And I have to look up how much exactly, but I'll share some pictures too. So we were a group of, I think, a total of 12 people. And all 12 of us, as well as our hosts and their grandkids, were able to fit into the ger. We had to, of course, squeeze on the floor. But it's a circular building. And I'm going to say it's maybe like 5 meters or so across, something like that. But I think in terms of sleeping, I think it would be pretty comfortable to have 6 people to a ger and still feel like you have space to lie down. And the ger doesn't have a floor per se. It's just set up on the land. And it has like a wooden structure that holds it up. And then there's felt and tarp over it to kind of keep it dry. And there is a stove set up in the middle that's used for cooking and heating.
Wow. So they literally dismantle this whole structure and pack it up and move it 4 times a year.
Yes. And you can, I hear that you can set it up and dismantle it in about 1 to 3 hours, depending on how many belongings the family has.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's incredible.
And it's usually the animals that tell them if it's time to move. Right. So during the day, the animals just roam and graze and live their lives. And at night, you know, if the herd is kind of new to the family, they're being herded into camp each night. But pretty soon the animals kind of catch on that at night we just go into camp and they just come into camp, which is what we witnessed. We basically were there and dusk started falling. Suddenly you had like a whole herd of yak just wandering into camp. The cows showed up. And the sheep and goats showed up and they just stayed there for the night.
That's amazing. That's so smart.
It is. And they just learned by repetition that's what we do. So
the humans equal security and that's where we go at night. That's really cool. I've noticed that with my own horses because the way I camp, if I'm able to, if it's safe enough, I like to let my horses roam free if I can. And they do the same thing. Whenever they feel insecure about something, they come back to our camp or they come at night for feeding time or first thing in the morning or whenever they want to sleep. That's really cool.
That's amazing. I mean, the animals we keep, that is an interesting difference that I noticed. The animals that we keep in the Western world generally don't have a lot of choice and control and agency in their lives. So I love that you're giving your animals that kind of ability to like be a little bit like self-sustained and make their own choices. That's super cool. Obviously safety is key, but yeah, I mean, the horse herds too, the horses live in herds and herd families. And when it's time to ride them, they are, you know, driven into a round pen and lassoed. And then you put a bridle on, and then they are horses that you might ride. But the idea of groundwork and preparing the horse to be ridden in the same way that we do in the U.S. or, you know, wherever, usually is not the same at all. So we kind of did a little bit of lassoing of the horses, and the horses were what I would describe as feral until they were in the bridle.
Interesting.
Which to me is so wild.
Yeah. I've heard that the Mongolian way of horsemanship is very wild. Like, they value the horse's spirit and they don't necessarily want to break the horse's spirit, but they need to use the animal. Am I correct in that assessment?
Well, I didn't have a philosophical discussion about horsemanship in this way with people, so I don't want to speak with people too much. But we had four people in the group that had ridden the Mongolian Derby and that had had some of those conversations a little bit. The way I understand it, with all these caveats, is that Mongolians really value the horse as a moving animal. So for them, it's a great pride, source of pride, if their horse is the fastest out of all the horses. They don't value a steady eddy trail horse or a schoolmaster or something like that. They want a horse that can go fast and can go long and is strong. And they see the idea of let's quote unquote tame the horse, make the horse safe on the ground, let's, be able to pick up the feet, as kind of taking away some of that kinetic energy. It takes some of that wildness out of them. So they're like, no, we're using them, and we're very proud of their ability to move. But then when they go back out with the family groups, they kind of become feral again anyway. So I think there's also an element of it being just not practical to put in so much effort and work into it's very different when a horse lives in a stall, gets their feet done every 4 to 12 weeks, depending on the horse and their feet, needs to be led to a field and back. That is not the case at all here. So these are not horses that get foot care or supplements or anything like that, right? So it depends. Some of the race horses these days do, from my understanding, but for the most part, they are out grazing, and that is how they sustain themselves, for example. Mm-hmm. So I think there's an element of this is how people like their horses. And there's also an element of it is not practical to put that much effort and work into a horse, because these people are also living off the land, working really hard, collecting food for the winter and things like that. So
right,
I think, yeah, there's a lot of moving pieces there.
So it's like a practicality thing. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get work done in the fastest and most efficient way possible.
I think so. I never saw any kind of machismo or people trying to assert their dominance over a horse just for the sake of dominating the horse. It was more like, I need to get this pack saddle on this pack horse. This pack horse hasn't done this much before. He's going to throw a fit. So we're going to just hang on to him. They're little horses, right? So it's a little bit harder to do this kind of stuff with a 17 hand warm blood versus a, 13 hand Mongolian pony. And then we'll just let him figure it out. And of course, there are horses that never figure it out. And those are then horses that are deemed, it depends. Lots of issues there, but maybe they're just for the daredevil riders, or they're not ridden that much. They're not used that much. You don't put your grandmother on them, right? But I think a lot of things that we would chalk up to either training or maybe even physical stuff, there it would more be like, that's just that horse's personality and being.
And how does that relate to their training and interaction and riding of the reindeer? Can you talk more about the reindeer experience?
Yeah, I would love to. So basically, I'm going to kind of continue telling the story of the trip. So we spent a night in horse camp, and the next day we were paired to a horse. So we rode one horse throughout the entire trip. So this group of the herders in the steppe don't ride the reindeer. They're not reindeer people. So reindeer have a very specific habitat in which they can live. And the steppe is not it. They need the, I think it's called the taiga, the like forested area with the bogs that is kind of colder. So we then set out on a two-day trip to visit the reindeer families. So I'll get there in a moment. So we basically were paired to a horse, and then we set out across the steppe. It was pretty fascinating to me. The newer pack horses were led. So you would have, us on the trip as tourists, and then we would have the herders, and they would have, they would sit on their horse and have two pack horses each and, be carrying a backpack and whatnot. And we would just kind of trot across the steppe. We spent a night in tents again. We can talk about that for a long time, because I think there's a lot of stuff that Mongolian people do with horses that in the Western world we might not. So we can chat about that later. And then we rode into the mountainous area where the taiga is, to the reindeer people. And then we stayed there. And I will probably never forget this. We were just up. We just arrived, and there's a custom of offering people like a black tea with milk. It was milking season when we were there. Obviously, milk isn't available all year round because refrigeration is not a thing, right? It's a whole thing. But we were lucky. We got reindeer milk tea. It was delicious. But there was like a moment when the reindeer herder, whom we called Grandpa, because he's an elderly man, you'll see a picture of him too, rode in on his reindeer, herding the entire herd. And his grandchildren are running along, herding everybody in too. And it was just like so otherworldly. Suddenly you have like these 60 reindeer in camp, and we're just like, wow. Yeah, it was so cool.
That's got to be so amazing. Like, what a cool feeling to be around these animals that I'm assuming you don't have experience with.
No, I've never seen a reindeer. No.
Majestic and kind of otherworldly, mm-hmm. with the big antlers and mm-hmm. yeah, that, oh man, it gives me chills just thinking about it.
It's a goosebumpy kind of thing. So what I noticed about I don't think that the reindeers would give Rudolph any kind of trouble.
Hey, look at the bee.
Look at the bee.
Hey, Maya's new.
Hey, Bobos. Stop calling me names.
Because reindeers are like the most gentle creatures you can possibly imagine. They are just so gentle and sweet in disposition. They're very like placid and calm. So on the first day we helped. So the reindeer get salt as a supplement. So we were able to help give the reindeer salt. They like love licking it from your hand, which feels very cool. They don't like the antlers touched because there's actually blood vessels in the antler. And I think that feels maybe this is a pure conjecture, but maybe ticklish to them. But they really did not mind being like scritched and pet, and they just have very, very thick fur, and you can just put your whole hand in there, and yeah, it's amazing. So basically the life of a reindeer herder, from what I can see, is that they take the reindeer out several times a day to graze. Well, they don't graze per se. They are looking for moss. They like to eat mushrooms. They obviously need to drink. Lichen is big for them too, and then certain plants as well. But there's actually no grass per se in that area where they like to go. The herder basically, usually it's just grandpa, just the one guy, usually takes the reindeer out, I think, two or three times a day for a number of hours to graze them and feed them.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And reindeer herders need to move more frequently because the reindeer live in very, like they can live well in very specific conditions only. And if, for example, global warming is incredibly hard on the reindeer herders because they have to go up higher and higher and higher to make sure that the reindeer get the nutrition and the kind of the conditions that they need to thrive.
That's one thing that I noticed in my recent trip to Romania. We went up into the Carpathian Mountains, and there the shepherding lifestyle is still alive and well. And we were discussing the fact that the tree line is getting higher and higher each year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there isn't as much snow. So there's a drought and everything is drying out. And it's just becoming a lot more difficult for the shepherds to maintain their sheep on what used to be alpine meadows. And now the forest is encroaching. So that's interesting to hear that the same sort of thing is affecting Mongolia.
Mm-hmm.
Scary.
Yeah, it is scary and it's sad. So this kind of stuff always makes it feel extra special in some way, because you're like, wow, is this going to exist in 20 years? I don't know, but I got to experience it. But yeah, we, of course, as humans at some point need to get our heads out of our butts and come together on this, as we know. But yeah, the next day we actually got to ride the reindeer, which was super amazing.
What was that like?
Oh, yeah. So reindeer are a small. And I was like, can these guys just carry us? But they can. So just like with horses, female animals don't carry riders. So only geldings and stallions, as well as I guess the same thing exists in reindeer too, though I don't know what they're called. So neutered and unneutered reindeers, male reindeers were riding animals. I think with the reindeer, it's also partially because the female reindeers are just a lot shorter and smaller. So I think it's just less practical to ride them. But they wore a saddle, just like a horse would. And we can talk about the Mongolian saddles. They're quite interesting and incredibly comfortable, I have to say. I was extremely skeptical getting up on one. And then I was like, you know, usually when I ride 7 hours a day, I get pretty sore, and I was not terribly sore riding 7 hours in these saddles. So I'm like, I want one. So hopefully if I go back, I can, I didn't have time this time, but I hope to bring one back because they were cool. Yeah. So the reindeer wear a saddle as well, and they don't have a bridle. So reindeer don't wear a bit, but they have like a strap around their head. And you just kind of use both a neck rein and direct rein to steer them. And it's not uncommon for the herder to just pick up a random stick and use it to tap the reindeer on the butt. But you can also use leg. And so it's not common to just use your leg in Mongolia for horses and reindeer. But people go, ch-ch-ch-ch. And that is the universal command to ask the animal to go forward. So most horses and reindeer were used to hearing that sound and then experiencing leg or stick. So they basically, once they heard it, they kind of skedaddled off. So riding a reindeer is like riding a fluffy cloud, I guess.
I imagine it's kind of like a fat pony with a really thick winter coat.
It's a skinny pony.
Or a teddy bear.
Yeah, they're not very wide. So you don't get on by putting your foot in the stirrup. You have to kind of put yourself over and then bring your leg over, which fortunately I was able to do. They are so basically the area where reindeer live and thrive is very, very boggy. That's just the head, the vegetation and habitat, I guess, where they feel the most comfortable and best. And the ponies had a lot of trouble navigating that kind of terrain. But the reindeer can just like, they're just kind of stepping over the rocks and the puddles. And because their hind legs naturally flex, right? They go into that, you know, they sit naturally just because they have that kind of shape in their hind legs. They're like shock absorbers, if you will.
Cool.
So you don't really, you're not like bouncing around as you would on a horse. They're just kind of like this the whole time.
Yeah. So it's a lot smoother.
Very, very smooth. Yeah.
And are they moving at a walk primarily, or do they trot like the horses do?
Well, hold on to your hat, because there are racing reindeers.
No way.
Yes. I did not go beyond a walk, because the guys that I was on were, I think, quite comfortable just moseying along. But a couple of us trotted, and they can even gallop and canter.
Wow. Do you know what the top speed of a reindeer is?
I have no idea. I have no idea. But I have a little video in which you will see a reindeer trotting that you can play. So,
cool.
Yeah. But yeah, most of us were pretty content to walk along. And then our job was, of course, to participate in the herding. So just like, you know, it really made me wonder if I might enjoy, you know, like working my horse on cows. Because it's really fun to just stay behind the herd and get the stragglers and, you know, keep everybody moving forward and together. It's not easy to herd a herd of reindeer with 10 people together, but you know, can work together. But it was a lot of fun. So you're kind of just like, oh, that one's going. I'll bring it back. Yeah, it's a good time. Usually that is something that Grandpa would do by himself.
Wow. You said it's difficult for 10 people to do it working together, but then this guy lives with them and handles them all himself?
Well, I'm pretty sure that they have a good understanding after all these years. And I also think that when you have 10 newbies trying this with a huge language barrier where basically someone is trying to explain it to you with pantomime, that's a little bit harder to learn. So, but yeah, it was a really, really wonderful time. We were out there for like 3-4 hours just herding them around in a big circle. And yeah, it's beautiful out there.
Wow, cool. That brings up a question of the language. So let me step back a little bit. How did you organize this trip? Did you go through a guiding service and did they have like interpreters and things all set up for you?
That's a great question. There's a lot of different touring agencies in Mongolia. And for me, when I go into a country that you know, is from such an economically different, I mean, people there, of course, the capital is different. But if you go into the country, I would say that people are poorer. And it is a third world country, right? So culturally very different, economically very different. So for me, it was really important to go with somebody who is ethical and who gives back to the people. So I didn't just want to go there and like gawk at people. That was really not my desire and intention. So I went with Eric Cooper Adventures, and we can link him too. He's got a great Instagram where you can see some of the stuff we just talked about. And he basically, over several years, I think it's been 10 years, he's very involved with the Mongol Derby. So he's like deeply, deeply involved with that. And he has, over the course of 10 years, built up relationships to the horse herding family and the reindeer herding families. And it's, you know, it's a family of like brothers that he has connected with. In addition to that, so obviously, he speaks a little bit of Mongolian, but he doesn't speak fluent Mongolian. So we had an interpreter with us, interpreter/chef/, you know, like helping us out if something went wrong person called Doogie. Super, super cool, like very generous with his knowledge. He's clearly kind of a city boy, but he had like picked up riding to do all of this. And he was just, you know, willing to translate all of the crazy questions we had and kind of help us understand a lot of the cultural aspects. So we had an adventure leader and then the interpreter/, you know, person who just helped us navigate this culture.
That's great, because I imagine it would be difficult to try to do it on your own. And it's like so different from our American understanding and way of being. To try to go to a country like that and organize a trip on your own. It's great that Eric has created his own agency and does these trips now based on his experiences at the Mongol Derby. That's really cool.
Yeah, it is. It is really cool. And he also shared a little bit of the issues that can happen because of the cultural differences. For example, I mean, it started... So the capital, Ulaanbaatar, is a large city. It reminded me of like Berlin crossed with Paris, you know, like with New York traffic. So it's not a place where you expect things to not go smoothly. But he said that for many years they had trouble with the hotel. And this is like a Holiday Inn. We're not talking about like a little mom and pop shop, losing reservations. people would pull up at 4 or 5 in the morning after the big long flights, and they would just be like, no, we don't have anything for you. And he would have to come in and really like lay down the law and go like, no, when it's my group, this is happening and we do this. So just expectations around punctuality, very, very different. Expectations around like predictability. Yeah. So I think he's worked really hard to create it, to make it a smooth experience for the people going on these trips. But I think he has to work very hard behind the scenes to kind of make that happen. And I'm sure that having the relationships with people that then come to understand how he operates helps a lot. And I know that he pays these people really well. And that was important to me. My money doesn't just go to like a white person, essentially.
Right. It goes back into the community that you're visiting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Can you give me a ballpark idea of how expensive a trip would be?
Oh my. Yes, I'm happy to. So the trip itself was $5,000. And then the flight was about $2,000. And I would say that I could have spent a lot of money in gear. I borrowed a lot of the camping gear, but I had to bring things like, you know, a sub-zero Fahrenheit sleeping bag. I had to have all kinds of things that usually cost a lot of money. So I would say I spent another $1,000 in gear, but I could easily have spent more. So I think ultimately we came out to about $8,000. And then obviously there I bought other things too, because, you know, whenever are you going to get like reindeer antler carvings?
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's money well spent. For sure. It's a once in a lifetime experience and just something so unique. Very cool. What other kind of like very unique or eye-opening experiences did you have? I'm sure that there was a lot of culture shock or just like discoveries based on their local habits and customs.
Yeah, so one thing that was really weird to me at first, but it turned out to be great for my body, is that these people don't have chairs, because you don't want to lug like a chair around with you.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So when a Mongolian nomad like arrives at a place, they just plop down and start lounging. They're very good at like squatting, lying on the floor, you'll see a picture too. I've got a great picture of some loungy people. And they're just like, all right, we arrived, we tied the horses up, let's lounge. We're like on the floor right now lounging. And they wear these garments that are called dal. It's basically like a coat with like a sash around the middle. You'll see it too in the pictures. And they can be taken off and you can lounge on them. It's very handy, very handy garment for lots of reasons. But yeah, just the fact that they go really hard, but then they take breaks really hard too. They're like ready to lounge any second. And they're really good at it. Like my body doesn't even relax on the ground like that. So basically, I didn't know this before I went, but our kind culture guide, Doogie, explained this to us. He gave some percentages, and I may be misrepresenting them, but he said about 80% of Mongolia is Buddhist. Yeah, I think it was Buddhist. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the temples in the capital, for example, that I saw, I visited a couple of things there, were, had Buddhist deities, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not that familiar with Buddhism, so I don't want to say the wrong stuff. But the area where we went to is very heavily shamanic. So there's shamans traveling the area, and they create these worship sites. And it's a custom, like when you see a shamanic worship site, you don't have to, but it's very common that you'll pull over. And then they look like, you'll see it in the picture too, they have like logs or sticks that are piled up to almost like a tent-like shape. And then often there's like ribbons tied into it. That's a very shamanic thing to do. Blue is a very like sacred color. All of the special horses and reindeer had like blue on their bridles as well. So when you see a, an animal that has blue, it's some kind of designation that this animal is special in a certain way. And then you go around. So this thing, the structure that I described is called an awa. And you go around three times and you toss a rock onto it each time you go around it. And usually you say, by tossing the rock onto the awa, luck comes back to me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a custom. That was really interesting. I'm not a religious person, but I am spiritual. And it seemed like a very like spiritual, almost like an ecstatic practice, the way shamanic rituals were described. So that was cool. We didn't meet a shaman, which I think is just fine, because I think those are very like sacred, private things to happen. But I saw a lot of those. Like, I was hiking in the mountains one morning, because I'm, you know, I like to get out there and move before we started out. And there was an hour at the top that had like horse skulls on it. And it's like, wow. It was crazy to me that everybody was driving a Prius. Don't know how a Prius can navigate those backcountry roads, but apparently it is possible. And, you know, you would have like entire families and their livelihoods packed into these either Priuses, lots of like Russian buses, or you had motorcycles. Lots of people just bopping along on a motorcycle. And we're like, this is hard for the horses. How is this motorcycle like crossing this river and doing these things? So, yeah, just the fact that people seem to be constantly moving was really, really cool to me and really weird, where I'm like, I'm so like, I mean, for you, Jessica, it's a little different because you have a trailer and you're more mobile. But for me, like, I have a house in the city. So just the idea, like, maybe next year we're going to camp somewhere else, we're not going to come back here necessarily, is so weird.
So many people here, at least in America, have their home. They've never thought any differently. Everybody collects belongings, and bigger is better. And it's definitely very different for people to wrap their heads around the idea of complete minimism or minimalism and not having the security of a home. It's fascinating to me even to know that there are other people. Like, I have a trailer. It holds my stuff. It's a heck of a lot easier than building a giant yurt and filling it with stuff and then having to pack it up again.
Yeah.
That's just an incredible amount of work.
Yeah, and for the reindeer herders, because the reindeer are less, their carrying capacity is just lower because they're much more dainty as animals. So the tendency is to create, so the herders live in what looks more like a teepee. So like tent-like structures. I have a picture too. Again, the same stove in there, which was very handy. We kept our stove in and like we would, it gets very cold in the mountains at night there by the Russian border, turns out. So we would kind of light the stove at night and keep us warm that way. It was really nice. Those structures generally tend to stay, and they just take the tarp and the, I actually don't know what the material is that is wrapped around, but it's waterproof. They take that with them because the reindeer just can't, that would be really impractical to carry a wooden structure on the reindeer. So they have a slightly different, so the Gers are more like the steppe people, but then the reindeer people have a different kind of living situation.
So I forget when it was, maybe 10 years, maybe even longer, a documentary came out about the people of the taiga, basically claiming that they were the happiest people on earth because they live such a simple lifestyle. Did you notice that in the people, that they are very happy? Like, I'm sure that it's a difficult way to live. They can't just all be completely carefree.
I have a lot to say on that. That's actually very interesting. So my Facebook friend, who now is my real life friend, Callie, she actually asked both the horse herder, who we called Uncle, and then the reindeer herder kind of leader, Grandpa, what makes you happiest in life? And that was translated through Doogie, our fantastic interpreter. And Uncle said, you know, the horse herder, he was like, well, when I was younger, I was in the military. That was pretty hard for me. But now I get a lot of joy out of seeing my kids and my grandkids thrive. That was kind of what he said. And then Doogie posed the same question to Grandpa, the reindeer herder. And he said, what kind of question is that? I am happy all the time. That was his response.
Wow.
So I would say that I think in the Western world, sometimes we can get kind of wishy-washy about our purpose in life. I'm a musician as well, and I've toured. And it reminds me a little bit of life as a touring musician, if that makes sense. Because when you are a touring musician, and I mean, I tell you, low lows and high highs, I'm not always happy when I'm on tour. But usually it's like you have a very clear-cut mission. Your goal is to go to the show, play the show, take from the city what you can, right? You know, see cool stuff, meet some cool people, have some good food, and then you're out, right? So it's a little bit like once you've accomplished your mission, you can just go like, I did my thing. This was great. I did it. And I feel like it's a little bit like that too. It's like, if I've taken my reindeer out 3 times, like I'm good. Like life is good. Like has a very specific, clear purpose, I think. And I do think, I mean, I think what I'm often missing in my life is that space to just be and think and just exist. And I think you get that a lot when you're herding a reindeer out there.
Do you think that it has to do with our Western culture is always about drive and ambition and success and leveling up and doing the next best thing? I wonder if having all of those options and knowing that, you know, like it's kind of like a grass is always greener on the other side syndrome. Like we have so many options and so many possibilities. And we're not necessarily achieving those. I don't know if I'm expressing this correctly, but it seems like in the herding societies where, you know, they have no need for a huge house and a mansion and a corporate job that pays them $300,000 a year or this or that or the other thing, they are able to be happier because they are just existing and doing their day-to-day requirements, like you said.
So I think in order to advance, like let's say advance in the broadest sense, technologically, for example, or when it comes to like, you know, in terms of like inventions or things that make life easier, unhappiness drives a lot of that, right? We're like, this is not quite working right, or I want more of this. So I do think that our culture kind of is based in that unrest, and we're kind of moving because we're like not happy where we are. And I felt like the herders were really happy where they are. Like for them, of course, I'm sure they would like, you know, certain things to be a little bit better here and there, but they're not constantly obsessing about how to make it so.
What about with their children? Are they encouraging their children to go off to the cities and become educated and get jobs other than herding, or are they encouraging them to stay with the family and continue the nomadic lifestyle?
That's a little bit hard for me to gauge, I have to say. I'm not 100% sure. I do know that the kids do go to school. That is something that I believe during the Russian occupation was kind of the education system was installed. I don't think before that a lot of the herder kids go to school, and it's a boarding school because it would obviously be very impractical for you know, like for a nomadic family to, you know, like be bound to a place like that. So I believe that the kids go to school. They were about to kind of go back to school, I think. I don't know if all of the kids go or if it's just, you know, like a number of kids, but I do think there's education for them. I can maybe just speak a little bit to the herding brothers that Eric had kind of created that relationship with. That might be helpful. So I think there were a total of 8 siblings. seven brothers, one sister, something like that. And out of these, one person had married a reindeer herder woman. Several of them were still horse herders. Some of them had married other herders. And then I believe one of them had moved to a bigger city and was not living the herding lifestyle, and one of them was with the military. So out of eight siblings, six were living the traditional lifestyle and two had moved on beyond that. Well, beyond sounds like a value judgment. I'm not trying to make that. Two of them had chosen something else for their life is maybe a better way to say that.
That's interesting. And it's, you know, I ask because I'm curious to know if the herding way of life is going to end, you know, like if they don't have their children to replace them, then that way of life is going to slowly go away. So I was wondering about how many of kind of like, what is the speed that this is happening?
Yeah, that's hard for me to gauge, I have to say. But I do think that a lot of kind of the next generation is still wanting to pursue that lifestyle.
Good.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's very, very special. I'm somebody who, I mean, it's always different when you're on vacation, but I can have, I can be prone to anxiety. Sometimes I have panic attacks. And that was just not a thing that I was even flirting with at all while I was out there. I was just so at peace with myself. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, why would you not want to be there and live like that? It's super cool. I also am, you know, I like my creature comforts, and sleeping in a tent is hard, and sleeping in a garret is not as comfortable as what we have. In general, Mongolian beds are very hard, even at the hotels. Like, wow, okay. I do like my little cushy, comfortable mattress. But yeah, it did give me a lot to think about, a lot of food for thought.
Do you think that was the most challenging part of the trip? Like, or was it more mental? Maybe the language barrier? What was the challenge that was the hardest for you?
That's a good question. I am a very good with the flow person. So I felt pretty comfortable to just kind of, you know, ride the ride. For me, I am somebody who has some food sensitivities. For example, gluten gives me a pretty upset system digestive wise. It can be embarrassing and annoying. And there are other things that I don't do super well with. And it was very difficult for me to eat well on this trip. I would say that the most challenging piece was the food. Mongolian people love mutton. I do not love mutton, turns out. So a lot of the food was like, you know, mutton dumplings, rice and mutton, mutton soup with noodles. You get the drift, right?
Yeah.
So one time on the way back, we actually speaking of like things being canceled, our charter flight was canceled and we had to actually drive back to the capital across the, you know, not, it's not like a freeway. It's more like, you know, a little country road that takes you there. So it took 12 hours to drive back to the capital. And we stopped for lunch at a restaurant and took some food away, and it was chicken. But the fries had been fried in mutton fat.
Oh, yuck.
Yeah, it was gross.
So they had the flavor of mutton.
Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah, that's rough.
So for me, I was like, the first couple of days, I was like, oh, what an interesting cultural experience I'm having. And then I'm like, oh, God, it's mutton again. Yeah. And just like, you know, there's a lot of unique stuff. Like there's a special kind of sourdough bread that they make. There's dumplings. So obviously I wanted to try some of this, and it did make my belly pretty upset. So for me personally, that was the hardest piece. Everything else, like I was expecting to have the tent sleeping be more difficult than it was. I actually slept well. It was comfortable. I was really worried about the riding piece because even though I've horse camped and ridden all over Oregon, I hadn't really ridden very much because my personal horse is currently non-ridden. And I was expecting to be incredibly sore, but none of that. none of that was really that difficult. My horse, actually, even though he was a little bit of a wild thing, he was perfectly safe under saddle at all gates. It was a little bumpy at the canter, but otherwise no complaints. I really expected to be worried about the riding piece, but it was great.
That brings us back to the saddles. Can you describe what the Mongolian saddle is like?
Yeah, I would say many good things are made out of some wood and some rebar, and that was basically the tree of the saddle. So you have two wooden pieces that are like this at an angle. It's hard to see. And then there's a rebar that connects the two pieces together, front and back. And then there's a cowhide in the middle, and that's the tree of the saddle. And then on the top of the saddle, you have like a big black cushion, kind of. That sits there. And then most horses, are when they get the saddle put on, they're wearing about 3 saddle blankets to really, like, you know, make that cush a cush experience. And then, of course, you have the stirrups with the round bottom and kind of like a bit, almost like a cage type thing. I have a good picture of the saddle, too. And then there's like a string holding the cushion on the saddle. So you're like, wow, this cannot possibly be comfortable at all. But I have to say, I mean, also these horses are smaller than our horses. So if you sit for 7 hours on a 16-hand draft horse, it's going to be a very different experience than on a pony. So just in terms of the hip flexors, that was more comfortable for me. But I mean, we trotted most of our riding days, especially my little guy. He was very little. I think he had the smallest horse. And he was just always like, everyone was walking and he's like doing his little tiny bum trot behind everybody. And I expected to really get my butt kicked because I hadn't ridden so much. And I know how it just, you know, let's say I went out and took a dressage lesson today, I'd be quite sore and in parts of my body. But I felt good the entire time.
That's great. You're so lucky. You hear so many horror stories about people with the horrible rubs and abrasions on their thighs and their knees and everything. And even just my own experience from endurance riding, like if one little thing is not right, like a little crinkle in the leather or something like that, you can end up with horrible sores when you're in the saddle for so long. So that's a real testament to the saddle structure and the cushioning of the hides and the leather that goes over it. That's really cool. And they use the exact same setup, basically, for the reindeer. Like, I imagine the tree of the saddle is shaped a little differently for the reindeer's back, but it's the same basic design.
I'm honestly not 100% sure, but it's quite possible that we were using the same saddles for the horses as for the reindeer, with just more cushioning.
Wow.
Yeah. The pack saddles also look pretty similar. They just don't have the cushion on top, and then the pack is kind of placed over that front rebar and the back rebar. One time my horse jumped something that I didn't think he would jump, and I got kind of pushed back behind the rebar and had to like pull myself back in front. It was pretty exciting. So Ouch. Getting your butt stuck on the rebar, not the best experience, but yeah, but otherwise, you know, I'd galloped and jumped in these saddles and I felt perfectly fine.
Wow. Very cool.
Mongolian riders generally tend to have a much shorter stirrup than we do. When I compared kind of the herders riding, first of all, I mean, they think nothing of jumping on a horse barefoot and bareback and riding out, galloping around. They do all kinds of crazy stuff. But in general, it seemed like the way, you know, we use a lot of leg riding in the Western world. But there it's all seat in hand. Leg is less important. But just in terms of, I mean, if you grew up as a young kid riding horses and galloping around all day, you're just going to be an amazing rider by the time you hit 15, 16.
Yeah, and, for sure.
No exception there. It's just, I mean, a lot of these, I think, there is like a cultural expectation, especially on male kids, to be very tough. Like crying doesn't get you anywhere, right? There's a guy who, one of the pack horses had a problem and wanted to get rid of its pack saddle. And one of the younger herders, I think he's about 16, grabbed the horse, dislocated his thumb in the process. And Uncle just came and put it right back in. And that was that, right? We don't cry. We don't moan. Like, we don't, we all fussed about him because we were worried. And it was almost like, he was like, heck off, guys. We gave him some ibuprofen. That was good then. But you know, like, we saw a young kid. How old was he? Maybe 6. Like, he fell, and I could tell it hurt him, and his face scrunched up, and he was like, okay, and then carried on with his day. Like, I think there's a hardiness.
Yeah.
Like, to the herding lifestyle that's kind of baked into the culture. Yeah.
Is there anything about this trip that you think has changed your perspective? I always hear a lot of stories from people coming back from Mongolia, like, oh, this was so incredible, and the freedom and the vastness and this and that and the other thing. Like, it's totally changed the way I think about the world, and I'm addicted to this freedom. Do you feel those kinds of feelings or something different?
Again, I'm a very go with the flow person. I am where I am, and I live in the way that's necessary to that space. It's definitely something that I want to experience again. So I think a lot of people that travel to Mongolia, not everybody, but a lot of people that travel there go, man, I want to feel that way again. I want to be there again. And I'm no different. So I'm already like, how can I finagle it? Like, can I put my savings back in order and go back sometime? Some of the people in our group are thinking about doing a trip to the Eagle Hunters.
Which sounds really cool.
To the west. Slightly different trip. So with our trip, we basically had, you know, 2 days driving, 2 days riding, 3 nights with the herders, 2 days riding, 2 days driving, maybe even 3 days. No, it was 2 days, yeah. So it was a lot of like movement. The Eagle Hunter trip, from what I understand, the way it's structured with Eric Cooper is you go to a place and then you ride out every day with your Eagle Hunter and accompany them on the hunt. So it's a little bit different in terms of what the trip does. But I'd love to experience that. I feel like I know a lot of people that I feel like would appreciate this. And I'm like, we should all go to Mongolia and do this cool thing. Though not everybody I know would want to ride like that. My partner, for example, not. But I'm like, maybe we should do a motorcycle trip. But I definitely have, I have a desire to experience that again. What I really loved and what bugs me about the U.S., you know, when you drive cross country, which you've done quite a few times, I gather, there's fences everywhere. Everything belongs to somebody. And that is not the case there at all. We saw one fence the entire time.
Wow.
And we just opened it and went through it and then closed it. But it's basically the idea that this is a communal and a shared land. And of course, you stake your place that you're going to hang out in. And there's winter shelters that are more built up to keep the animals safe. It's more like you can go and nobody's telling you you have to be there. And just that, like, not being a slave to the clock in the same way that a lot of us are in the Western world, that is addicting. That's cool. And I do want that a little bit more for myself in my own life, though currently I don't know how that would be possible.
I have one more question that's really been on my mind since I realized that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you primarily do positive reinforcement training. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, we can get super like technical and difficult now, but I use methods with both horses and dogs for the most part when I'm training that I would describe as force-free or rewards-based, if you will. Though I still occasionally ride traditionally. You know, I might borrow someone's horse and ride in a dressage clinic, or might just go on a trail ride. And then it's obviously a horse that's been trained with pressure and release, and that is fine. But yeah, I would say so.
And I'm a little bit of the same way. Like, if you talk to a real traditionalist in the positive reinforcement world, they're gonna really nitpick. But I would call myself primarily positive reinforcement with traditional mixed in, because you know, that's how I was raised and how I learned to ride and handle horses. Mm-hmm. And it's like I try to be as force free as possible. But I find in myself that ever since I've been opened up to force-free methods and really learning more about animal behavior and communication and learning, I am a lot more sensitive. I mean, I was always sensitive to animal cruelty and abuse and things, but I'm much more sensitive now. And I find that it's very difficult for me to travel to undeveloped countries that are not as advanced in animal welfare. And even around the U.S., there are certain places, like I can't even go to horse shows anymore, really. So I'm a little extreme.
Yeah.
But I was really curious to know from your perspective, having that background, if you had a conflict of interest or if you had feelings or incidents where you were like, ooh, I feel an ethical dilemma here.
That is really interesting as a question. I'm going to say that I did not feel an ethical dilemma, and here's why. So I did a little research beforehand, and I'm like, oh, this is going to be very, very different. But it was pretty clear to me that I wasn't going to come into a different culture and judge it. So I'm like, I'm not going to go in there and tell these people, like, how to handle their horses. So I was there as an observer. And obviously, when I rode my own horse, I was like, oh, I can train this horse to the bridle within 10 days. That's fine. I can get that done. Like, he understood what I was communicating by the end of it. So I would say that there were incidents where I was like, oh, like this would be so much lower stress for the animal. And also sometimes for the people, if the horse had been taught through shaping, right? Let's not even talk about positive reinforcement. That's not a thing in Mongolia at all. And safer for everybody as well, like physically safer. For example, there was an incident where a pack horse got loose and, you know, kicked the bags off and ran around and dislocated the person's thumb and, you know, ran into a whole herd of horses. And that is a little bit scary. Or if you see like a horse held down to get the packs put on, that's not great. Or if you see a horse lassoed and then the bridle kind of forced on it, that's like, yeah, that's like, and I was like, oh, but that's the different, that's, I mean, there's no shared language to talk about animal training. And one of my friends that I made there, her name is Sam. She rode in the Mongol Derby twice, once when she was 40 and once when she was 50 this year. And she came second, I believe, this year. She said that, I'm not sure which Derby it was at, but that a friend of hers had been at the Derby too. I think it was the first one. And he was like a natural horsemanship kind of guy from maybe South Africa. And he had kind of taken a couple of the young horses that the herders had brought and had used the natural horsemanship techniques on them. And the herders were all like, yeah, that's cool. We don't like our horses to be that way. Right.
Wow.
So I think it's almost like we're on different planets.
Okay.
Especially me with my positive reinforcement and the herders. And I'm like, I'm just going to go to a different planet and watch the planet.
Okay.
And I'm not going to come in and judge the planet. That's not what I'm here to do. If that makes any sense.
It does. Yeah. It's good that you were able to compartmentalize it that way and look at it from that perspective.
Yeah. I think there's no, I mean, would I do this? No. Do I think it's a great way to handle a horse? No. But I'm also like, this is literally a culture I'm observing that's been around for hundreds of years, thousands maybe, I'm not sure. Well, yeah, I mean, Genghis Khan and all that, right? So I'm not there to tell them they're doing it wrong. That would be kind of messed up. So, I was able to kind of keep those pretty separate. But, you know, it's nice to come back and like recall my pony from the top of the hill and she comes running down and whinnying. I'm like, yes, this is what I like. You know, training her to accept injections because the vet's coming next week, that kind of thing. I'm like, yes, this is what I like to do.
Yeah.
But it also made me realize, because my horse is non-ridden And most of my work now is, you know, like trick training, husbandry training, which is great. But it made me realize how much I miss riding. And it made me go, maybe I do want to lease a horse or find a horse who enjoys it and just get out there next year and trail ride. And that was good for me personally to just go, there's so much joy there and I've missed it so much. And there's been so much grief around not riding my horse. But maybe that's something I could do and I could do ethically and I could enjoy.
That's great. Well, you can always come visit me.
I would love that very much.
Well, it's been so awesome talking to you. Tell me, how can people find you if they're interested in connecting?
Absolutely. So I have a podcast as well. It's not no video, just audio, but it's wherever podcasts are found, including Apple, Spotify, all the usual suspects. It's called Reward Your Dog Podcast. And while it is, I know this is a horse podcast, while it is about dog training, not horse training, we get into a lot of kind of interesting concepts that I think could be interesting for horse folk too, especially like nervous system stuff, what is exposure training, that kind of stuff. I think that could be something that horse folk could take some stuff away too. I do have a horse business that's currently on pause. It is called Reward Your Horse Training. You can see a pattern forming. I'm hoping to offer some online content, maybe 2025. I'm still working on that. And then I have, of course, my dog training business called Reward Your Dog Training, which I'm sure you will link. You can find me there. And I got look at the usual channels, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook. So if you want to connect, I guess, I don't know if that's show notes per se, but those would be a great place for that. So,
yes, I would definitely put that in there and it'll be in the YouTube description. I want to let everybody know, actually, I'll have to announce this at the beginning, but for anybody listening on audio, make sure you switch over to Ride Climb on YouTube because we're doing our podcasts in video format now and you'll be able to see all the awesome photos and videos of where Verena has been.
Yeah, I brushed my hair for this occasion. So,
yeah, knowing that you're going to be on video is a good excuse for personal hygiene.
yes, indeed.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. And this has just been a fascinating conversation. And I'm so curious about Mongolia. I have been for years. And it's just so cool hearing your stories. I love it. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me on.